From Colorado to New Jersey, Wisconsin to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the radical left is continuing its push in Congress for a federal takeover of the election process. Ken Cuccinelli from the Election Transparency Initiative is here with details. The U.S. Justice Department is now labeling parents who speak out at school board meetings as domestic terrorists. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Supply chain issues are affecting many businesses. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Sean Higgins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute about how domestic policies are making the problem worse. And the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, demonstrated the high value America places on every life. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Efforts by the ultra-left wing of the Democratic Party are continuing to push for a federal takeover of elections, which constitutionally and historically have been the province of the states. Ken Cuccinelli is a former Virginia Attorney General and served in the Department of Homeland Security during the Trump administration. He is now chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative and joins us with details. Ken, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Ken, all of the attention in Washington the last couple of weeks has been on the proposed $3.5 trillion social spending bill, the infrastructure bill, the debt limit, the federal budget, all those sorts of things. But still perking through Congress is this election bill that would have dramatic and draconian consequences. Please remind our audience what this bill is and what Democrats in Congress are attempting to do.
It's a little more confusing even than that, because they have several versions of several bills floating around, and I would say they have been careful not to be very particular about which bill they expect to advance next. However, to the later part of your question, they all essentially are different forms of a federal takeover of state elections. One of them would be doing that directly, H.R. 1, and another does it by running all changes to state election laws through the voting section of the Department of Justice, which, as the Obama Inspector General of the Department of Justice found, was peopled disproportionately with very left-wing lawyers. Literally, these are people coming from the ACLU, La Raza, and so forth. These are not just ordinary career professional lawyers. These are people coming there to change your state's election laws. So it isn't clear which route they'll take, but there's no question it does things like attack voter ID. It orders states to do things, to undertake many of the practices that you saw in 2019 and 2020 that resulted in such loose election execution with so many problems. And one wonders, why do you want to introduce so many of these problems intentionally? And I think that's a very legitimate question to ask. It seems like they want to make it easy to cheat and hard to prove, whereas those of us working on election security and transparency want to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. I would note, it's never been easier to register to vote or to vote than it is today, no matter what color you are, no matter where in America you live or what party you affiliate with. So there's a lot to celebrate, especially when you look back to, say, the Voting Rights Act era.
To be clear, Ken, the whole issue of voting and how elections are conducted, that has historically always been the province of the states, correct?
Yeah, absolutely, since the time of the Constitution, and it was expected to remain as such unless there were situations where the states literally refuse to hold federal elections, that you can read through the Federalist Papers and so forth and see that sort of expectation. So the power exists there for the federal government to exercise, but that was intended only as an emergency fallback. It wasn't intended to simply take over the day-to-day execution of elections, which is what the radical leftists, the other Democrats are going along with them, but this is a product of the radical left here. And frankly, I find in very blue states that there are many senior Democrats who are quite concerned about their fellow farther left Democrats and this sort of election practices, things like ballot trafficking. People, you know, we saw the drug dealer out there in California who also had 300 ballots in his trunk. Well, that's rather interesting, isn't it? How did that happen? And the way that happens is loose practices and procedures that allow for the opportunity for people like that to cheat.
Where does all this stand in Congress, Ken? Because we all know that the left is the tail wagging the dog in the Democrat Party in Congress. So the fact the left is pushing this would seem to indicate it's going to get at least an airing or a hearing, if not an actual vote. So where in the sausage-making process does this stand?
Sure. So only one bill, no bill, has had a committee hearing in the House. They just literally brought it to the floor, rammed them through. These are 800-page bills of takeover of elections and so forth. Not a single committee hearing on a bill. They've had committee hearings with rather loaded names, if you will, but there was no bill before the committee. In the Senate, one committee, the Rules Committee, has had one hearing with a bill before it. That was H.R. 1, S.1. Now they're in varying forms of what's called the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which sounds very nice when you put it that way, but it's still a federal takeover of elections. And it has not gone to through committee. We expect it to be brought straight to the floor. And to your point about the left pushing in the Democrat Party, the reason Chuck Schumer is being as aggressive as he is afraid, like so many other Democrats, of being primaried by far left person. In this case, he is afraid of being primaried by AOC. So there's a very particular reason Chuck Schumer is pushing on this as hard as he is. And people should know that this is the bill that they plan to try to break the filibuster on. The filibuster is the Senate rule that requires a supermajority to move forward on a bill. And that's at risk here. It's been in place for 170 years, and it's one of the things that distinguishes the Senate from the House. And the left is pushing people like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema and others to throw out the filibuster by majority vote and then pass the radical election bills by majority vote instead of having to go get some consensus with the Republicans. And it's worth remembering the original Voting Rights Act, part of its power was the overwhelmingly bipartisan support that it had to fix the problems of 1965. Not a single Republican has voted for a single one of these bills yet, and Democrats, in some instances, have voted against them, including someone as prominent as Benny Thompson, a committee chair, and we see him heading the January 6th so-called commission. So these are not junior folks. These are bills with very serious problems. They're very aggressive in their intent and would dramatically undermine the quality of American elections and make it very hard to have confidence in the outcome of elections.
We have been talking with Ken Cuccinelli, who is chairman of Election Transparency. And Ken, tell us a little bit about Election Transparency and also a website for your organization.
Yeah, the Election Transparency Initiative is a joint project of the Susan B. Anthony List, biggest pro-life group out there, and American Principles Project, a pro-family organization. And they both recognize that they can win hearts and minds if they can fight on a level playing field. And so they started this project to make sure that the playing field, in this case elections, stays level. And that's what I work on every day. Our website is electiontransparency.org. And I can be followed at Ken Cuccinelli on Twitter.
Ken Cuccinelli of Election Transparency. Ken, thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. A number of interesting developments in Washington, D.C., both within the administration and at the U.S. Capitol. We're going to talk about all of that today. Scott, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Let's start with the Department of Justice, Scott. They raised a lot of hackles this past week, wanting to say that parents who appear before school boards and disagree with school board policies are domestic terrorists. What's that all about?
Yeah, well, I think we've seen over the last 18 months a lot of parents starting to get engaged in local education decisions, going to school board meetings. We've seen those viral moments that show parents upset about mask mandates, about vaccines in children, and also about critical race theory being taught in anything from kindergarten all the way up to high school. And so throughout America, we've seen parents really get a little bit aggressive with some of the school board members. We've seen their microphones cut off. We've seen protests outside of schools. And the bottom line is, it's actually been a pretty healthy conversation for parents and school administrators to have, because for far too long, I think parents have sat out these K through 12 educational decisions that are ultimately teaching children what to believe when it comes to the history of America and what it comes to believe when it, you think about the Constitution and overall American history. And so this week we saw the Attorney General Merrick Garland issue a memorandum to the FBI and the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division and also all U.S. attorneys, and basically calling for a new investigation and conversation with local law enforcement to try to figure out exactly what's going on with these threats and identifying them when they occur and actually prosecuting them when appropriate. We obviously don't want to have folks breaking the law and committing crimes of violence, but there is something to be said about peaceably assembling and also addressing grievances within your local governments when it comes to education. But we've got federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial leaders that are now going to be convening meetings with the FBI and U.S. attorneys, and within 30 days, trying to make decisions about addressing these threats within the school administrations. The Department of Justice went on and effectively called these Americans that are protesting domestic terrorists. And I think that that's a real problem when you equate violence that can ultimately kill hundreds of people through real domestic terrorism, like the Oklahoma City bombing, with a parent raising their voice over the treatment of their third grader. And so what we're seeing now is conservative activists that are sort of doubling down and organizing additional rallies against school administrators and school boards that are really trying to teach this woke culture through critical race theory.
Meanwhile, we have a whole wide range of financial, fiscal issues continuing to perk on Capitol Hill. Congress not dealing with them this week, but we did have the issue of the debt limit, which we're rapidly approaching. Mitch McConnell backing down on that. Can you give us some background on that?
Internally, Mitch McConnell was starting to hear concerns from several senators. A few of them went public, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, John Barrasso from Wyoming, and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, all indicated that they were not ready to really shoot the hostage when it came to the debt limit, and that ultimately they weren't going to allow for a default on our full faith and credit of the United States through our debt obligations. And so when McConnell met with senators this week, he decided to come forward with an agreement that would provide for a short-term debt ceiling increase for about 2 months, which ultimately puts us back up against another one of those Christmas deadlines, crisis through legislating. And McConnell also said that he'd be willing to do a long-term debt limit increase in exchange for Democrats relenting and stopping their partisan reconciliation legislation, the $3.5 trillion package with about $3 trillion of tax increases that we've talked about several times over the last few months here on the program. And so what you've really got is Mitch McConnell concerned, because the media, they skipped over this idea that the Democrats could actually increase the debt limit on their own through reconciliation, which is a technical process that could be accomplished. And McConnell also offered to basically yield back any objections from the Republicans to help accommodate a partisan increase from the Democrats, as unlikely as that was to occur. And so McConnell talked to Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona. He talked to Joe Manchin from West Virginia and basically became aware that other liberals in the Senate Democratic Caucus were threatening filibuster reform in order to stop Republicans from blocking any debt limit increase. Mitch McConnell obviously is a strong supporter of the filibuster, and so ultimately he went ahead and caved and made an offer to the Senate Democrats. Now, in the past, when Senate Democrats have threatened to abolish the filibuster, McConnell, I think, has rightly pointed out that there are all sorts of tactics that Republican senators could take to really bring the work of the United States Senate to a grinding halt. And they could force a quorum in a 50-50 Senate, meaning you have to have a majority of senators on the floor in order to do any actual Senate business, official business of the United States Senate. And that's a constitutional requirement. So it's something that the Senate Democrats would not be able to change the rules pertaining to. And McConnell actually isn't even talking about that this week, right? He instead is basically caving after several months of political posturing that we all knew was inevitable when it related to the debt limit.
We, of course, will continue to keep an eye on all of this with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 500,000 members from all 50 states in America that are united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty. And if anybody wants to check us out and actually become a member for free, you can do so on our website, clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Disruptions in the supply chain are impacting many industries, and some domestic policies are aggravating the problem. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Sean Higgins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
There's a lot in the news these days about supply chain issues and how much of that has to do with international trade. And actually, it turns out a lot of it has to do with some domestic issues, some things that maybe we haven't paid enough attention to in the years before the pandemic, but that are now causing all sorts of backups, meaning that it's a longer wait for you to get stuff you order online, means higher prices, means all sorts of chaos for businesses from coast to coast. That's what we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Sean Higgins. He is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He studies labor and employment issues, and he joins us on the phone now to talk about a piece that he wrote this week. You can find that piece at CEI.org. America needs more truckers on the road, and not just more truckers, as it turns out, but more port workers, more workers everywhere. Sean, thanks for taking some time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me here, Eric. Glad to do it.
Glad to have you here, as always. I love the work that CEI does here. I think one of the things that you highlight in this piece, and there's a bunch of kind of interesting things here that I think have been kind of undercovered by the media and politics in general, but commercial truck drivers have some pretty strict limits on how much they can drive, and that's one of the things that's constraining the way supply chains are working right now.
Yeah, they can only drive for 11 hours in a 14-hour workday. That's according to federal safety regulations. And that's something that the unions have, the Teamsters and others, have fought to prevent any changes to. They say it's basically for safety reasons, and probably that's probably a factor, but it also means that since they can't work that many hours, the hours they work become that much more valuable.
There's a similar issue at ports, and specifically you highlight two of the ports on the West Coast, two of the biggest ports for stuff coming into the country. And the same sort of thing there, where there's just these rules that they take Friday off or something like that, even when there's all these ships backed up waiting to come in.
Well, that comes down more to union contracts in those particular cases. There's no particular reason why the ports on the West Coast couldn't run 24/7. In fact, they have some sort of limited operations in that regard. They just don't, because the contracts they have with the longshoremen's unions and others make it prohibitively expensive for them to run 24/7 operations, and so they just don't do it. The other issue that I didn't get into the piece I wrote, but that I'm working on the sort of follow up stuff, is the ports are not as automated compared to other international ports, and that's another thing that the unions have fought against. They see automation as, you know, a direct threat to them, so they fought tooth and nail to prevent that, and as a consequence, not only do they have, you know, limited amount of workers and limited work time the workers can work there, but you know, they can't get as much use out of those workers because they don't have the robots to assist them, essentially.
I guess if I'm going to play devil's advocate for the unions here, and I don't like doing that, but if I have to, I would say, you know, maybe they're concerned about safety, they're concerned about workers being overworked, maybe not so much an issue at the port, because as you point out, they could have more automation to help workers, you know, do more in the amount of time that they're there. But truck drivers, for instance, I mean, if you're on the road for 11 hours, 12 hours a day, there's an obvious safety issue there. Whenever I'm driving down the road, I always wonder, you know, if the truck next to me, if that guy's had enough sleep or something like that. Is that a concern? Like, how much of a concern is that? How much of that it needs to be balanced here?
That is a concern. I mean, obviously, you don't want someone literally falling asleep at the wheel when they're driving an 18-wheel rig down the highway. But there's a long tradition of, and I've linked to that in the piece because it's just kind of the quirkiness I do, of like truckers driving like extremely long hours to get stuff from one place to another. Even there's a whole bunch of country western songs about that. The problem is just that the rules create no flexibility. I mean, obviously, you don't want all drivers driving 20-hour days or something like that, but some of them can. I mean, that's what they do. And we ought to be able to sort of recognize that different people can do it different ways, or to at least allow some ability to alter the rules to address these sort of issues.
We're talking with Sean Higgins. He's a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, talking about some of the kind of undercovered aspects of the supply chain issues that are bedeviling the economy at the moment. Sean, just a couple of minutes left here, but I guess it's important to point out that so much of this has been kind of exposed by the pandemic and some of the sort of weird consequences of it. But I mean, most of these problems, the lack of flexibility in union contracts, for example, the union's opposition to automation at the ports, all of that. I mean, those things predate the pandemic. These were just issues that we ignored before because they weren't front and center.
Yeah, we were able to sort of get by as things were. And inertia is a powerful force in politics and governance and a lot of things. But as the volume increased in reaction to the pandemic, that just sort of exacerbated these issues. For example, the empty ship containers pile up at the ports, and there's nobody to move them out because the lack of truckers and the lack of people coming in and out. At the same time, the ships at sea have a shortage of the containers that they need because they're all stuck at the ports. So, and these problems just sort of compound each other.
Yeah, and that makes the containers more expensive, which is another problem we're seeing now too, right? Just how expensive it's become to ship them.
Yeah, and another interesting fact that most people don't know about, the vast majority of truckers out there are independent operators. About 90% of them work with companies with like five or fewer trucks. More people would be getting into this, except the cost of trucks has gone up. And the reason why the cost of trucks has gone up is because we can't get the raw materials in, because we can't ship them. So you see how these sorts of things just sort of compound and play on each other.
Everything is so interconnected. It's one of the reasons why central planning always fails, one of the reasons why the government schemes always fail, because you just can't account for all the ways that the economy is interconnected. I think this is a great illustration of that. We're unfortunately out of time for today, but Sean, really appreciate you being here. Interesting take on all of this.
Thank you.
And again, that is Sean Higgins, a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You can check out his work at CEI.org. They do a lot of other fantastic work as well. Check out more of our coverage of all of these issues at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Valuing every life is an American hallmark and stands in stark contrast to the disregard demonstrated by the September 11th, 2001 terrorists. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this American Radio Journal commentary.
A few weeks ago, the nation once again remembered the events of September 11, 2001. We again recalled what had happened and remembered its victims. This was the 20th anniversary of 9/11, after all. It was a sad landmark. Our tendency with these anniversaries of 9/11 is to pay tribute for a few days with documentaries on cable channels, and then we move on. But this time around, however, I heard a remembrance of 9/11 that I think others should hear and carry forth with them all year round. On September 8, 2021, Paul McNulty, the president of Grove City College, which is where I teach, spoke in Pittsburgh regarding his uniquely fascinating yet very somber 9/11 experiences. McNulty played an intimate role in the prosecution of the 9/11 hijackers and their associates. He did this as a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia and as deputy attorney general in the Bush administration. The audience was riveted as McNulty walked through the anguish moments from 7:59 a.m. to 10:03 a.m. on September 11th, starting with the takeoff of the first hijacked jet and ending with the crashing of the last flight, Flight 93, in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. What especially stuck with me from that talk was the contrast in how the Islamist terrorists view human life versus how we do. McNulty recounted Osama bin Laden speaking from his Taliban-controlled sanctuary in Afghanistan in February 1998, where Osama ordered, quote, "kill Americans wherever and whenever." This was an edict against every American, soldier or civilian, young or old, Marines or babies. On 9/11, they targeted all of them. McNulty recounted a grisly exchange between 9/11 plotter Zakaris Moussaoui and U.S. Attorney Robert Spencer in March 2006. Asked by Spencer if he had any regrets, Moussaoui conceded none. He said, quote, "I just wish it will happen on the 12th, the 13th, the 14th, the 15th, the 16th, the 17th. I can go on and on. There is no remorse for justice," unquote. Moussaoui told Spencer that he enjoyed listening to the chilling testimony from Pentagon victims. It made him smile. He said, "I would have even laughed if I didn't know that I would be kicked out of the court." Asked by Spencer, "So you enjoyed seeing the Pentagon on fire?" Moussaoui replied, "My pleasure." When asked his reaction to the harrowing testimony of Lieutenant Colonel John Thurman describing crawling out of the building with his face against the floor, Moussaoui sniffed. He was pathetic. "I was regretful he didn't die." Asked about those who did die, Moussaoui celebrated, "Make my day." To Moussaoui, if only every day could be like 9/11. "You'd like it all to happen again, right?" Spencer asked Moussaoui, who affirmed, "Yes, every day." In contrast, Paul McNulty recalled how the victims of 9/11 have been remembered by Americans, right down to their scarcest physical remains. He noted that only 1,100 sets of remains were found of the 2,800 or so who perished under the World Trade Center buildings. Most were pulverized. Among those 1,100, McNulty noted that each time remains were found in subsequent weeks by personnel on site, the entire place silently stood in order, heads bowed, as the remains were slowly carried away from ground zero. The contrast between how one side views human life versus the other could not have been clearer. Every September 11th, we remember the dead and we pray for their families. We don't seek violent deaths as suicide martyrs for a God that wants us to kill. Our God is the author of life. We plead for life. But to radical Islamists like Moussaoui and bin Laden, God is the master of the sword, not of the cross. Not of love and mercy, but of their distorted view of justice. America's Judeo-Christian roots have taught us to honor the sanctity and dignity of every human being as made in the image of the Creator. This has long made America different, and let's hope and pray that it always remains so. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WVWP-FM in Fort Gay, West Virginia, KNSS-AM in Wichita, Kansas, along with WMWX-FM in Liberty, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.